Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. And in the studio today, I got a very interesting fellow. His name is Professor Robert Figueroa, and he's from Oregon State University. And he's actually in a, well, it's not a department. It's a school of history, philosophy, and religion. So you're thinking, wait a minute, have I got the wrong program here? No, this is Science Studio.
It is.
And we're going to be talking a lot about the environment, environmental justice, environmental philosophy, or the philosophy of the environment, if there is such a thing. So stay tuned. It's going to be an interesting half an hour. So, Robert, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Now, what is your claim to being on a science program? And very quickly...
I'm going to throw this out there, probably something you wouldn't have expected. First of all, anything that's public environmental issue is going to have to intersect with science.
But it's nice to hear that, yes, because there are people out there, a lot of them up in the Northeast, especially in Washington, D.C., yeah, that don't get that connection.
Yeah, they fail that. They
science
fail that
has
connection.
Got nothing to do with environment.
That's right. And fortunately, you know, part of what we'll be talking about today are how communities wield science and have in some ways informed scientists and in some ways developed citizen sciences and then in other ways have worked, you know, collaboratively with scientists.
Okay.
So I think this is a good place.
Good. Excellent. So welcome again. But before we get into all those intersections, you must have been five or six at some stage. How did you develop a career? I mean, okay, you go to school, you obviously got a PhD and all that, but when you were little, what were you searching for or what did you think was being thrust upon you and how did you make your decisions?
Yeah, thank you. So I grew up between the Jersey Shore, and if you're looking for where that place may be, just look for the reports on Superstorm Sandy, which obliterated the intercoastal waterways where I grew up. But I also grew up with a Puerto Rican family in Puerto Rico and went back and forth between the states as a child. And so I had this great exposure between the states and Puerto Rico. There's two things here. One is I thought I would be, you know, a soccer player or a pilot or something like that. And I was good enough at soccer until I realized, you know, that I couldn't keep up running. And I was good enough in aeronautics and mathematics and science to be very interested in it until I realized that my military dreams as a pilot were probably the last thing I actually wanted to do out of my own conscience. So where does philosophy come in? Well, this is an interesting scientific point of view. When I was a kid in Jersey, during the late 60s and early 70s, there were two really important people who came to your neighborhood in the summer. There were two trucks. One was a good humor truck. When those bells rang, you wanted ice cream. The other was someone called the Mosquito Man. The Mosquito Man went through your neighborhood and gassed the neighborhood with DDT. And every household closed their windows, and every child went out in the streets, and every child got on their bikes, and they got into the cloud, and they bumped into each other, and they got dizzy, and they did all these things. And that seemed really normal to do. And a lot of the folks that I grew up with were people who were transports from very urban petrochemical parts of Jersey and lived really, you know, way too close to Exxon and Getty plants and refineries. So after a couple of years of enjoying the Mosquito Man, DDT was finally outlawed, and I found myself spending many of my childhood days in an oxygen tent because I had severe asthma from the conditions of the ambient air, but obviously DDT inhaling wasn't best for me. And I really had a lot of time as a sick child, constantly reflecting, constantly thinking, watching old movies that were moral movies, and really started to become a very reflected, calming person. And the last thing to say is when you're a sick kid, you're out of school for a time, and you have to reintegrate very quickly. And even if you were a popular child, when you're gone for a week, everybody's forgotten you. So I would often find myself coming back into the fold of my classes, and I would see how others were treated who were the marginalized and who were, you know, the outcasts. And I would be with them for the first couple of days until popularity grew back or something like that. So I had this incredible sense of, you know, unfairness that was going on in social life, but also this real opportunity to reflect. And I think that gave me some philosophical orientation. And honestly, I decided after I became an adult at 18 when I was going to sign my selective service card so that I could get financial aid or something. I decided there's just the idea of warfare and things of this sort where I would be a violent person just wasn't going to match up with it. So I launched into a scientific career in cognitive psychology at Rutgers University, and I learned very quickly that that's not what I wanted to do, but I wanted to know how people thought. And I wanted to know.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Don't you want
to
know how you think?
So I ventured there. I ventured into philosophy, and that was a good place for me.
Before we get onto that, I want to go back to a little bit. You mentioned DDT,
mm-hmm.
and then, of course, it's the ethical question. You said, well, DDT is banned everywhere. Of course, it isn't. There are societies around the world that have come to a conclusion that not to use DDT is more of a deleterious decision than actually using DDT. So there's an ethical feature right there, which is by no means simple to evaluate.
That's right.
I mean, you know, I hear a lot of people saying, well, we should ban this, ban the other. But you do have to look at the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose this has got something to do with perhaps utilitarian philosophy. I don't know. Most good for more people or less bad for less people. I don't know quite how it goes.
Yes.
How do people make decisions in the 21st century when we've got so much information, you know, developed societies like ours?
Yes.
We see the world through our prism, but we've got no clue what it must be like to be in another environment where, for example, malaria is rampant and the mosquito is in there doing its number.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it speaks to the contradictory tone that we have where we banned DDT at one point. And it was actually part of the origins of an environmental justice movement when Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers teamed up with the Coalition and Environmental Alliance and the Environmental Defense Fund to have DDT banned. So there's an interesting environmental history here, which was it wasn't environmental groups per se that just banned this because it was hurting all the eagles and the birds. And we get that out of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which kicks off the second wave of the American environmental movement. It were farm workers who were Filipino and Chicano, and they were and Mexicano, and they were the ones who were teaming up with the environmental groups. But there was a coalition involved. Now, right there, I think it's a question of who's getting the detriments of the chemical, and in this case, it's a pesticide that was being sprayed on workers as well as the crops. No one was taking time off of the crops while spraying was going on.
Yeah, but they weren't doing what you did as a kid, just following the,
that's
the
right,
spray.
That's right.
I mean,
that's right.
They were part of the experiment. In
yes,
a sense.
They were part of the experiment. And there were multiple cities that were part of the experiments as well. And but we need to find the source. What's the source of DDT? The source of DDT is a synthetic chemical that won in some ways World War I in trench warfare, and it seized typhus for the Allied troops. And that's one of the ways we won the war. We stopped being sick, but the same parties, DuPont and Hooker Chemical and others who were getting these bids with the U.S. Chemical forces, were also the ones that invented napalm. They kept up the same ideas going, and they were also the manufacturers of some of the worst waste products, not good products that we use, but the waste of those good products that we use, like lead paint waste or ethylene glycol waste, or that were put in pits of neighborhoods of people who were much like the people where DDT was being sprayed. So first we have to realign how did DDT get on the market, where did it come from, and then how did it sustain itself? And one way that it sustained itself is it started out as a gift of the war. It made the United States a leading chemical manufacturer. It was a baby. It was not even recognized as a chemical manufacturer until we were able to cut off the German forces. That was where chemicals were coming from, was Germany. That's why, you know, chemical warfare was so attractive. But it really was us then, you know, we gained it. Hooker and DuPont, Occidental Chemicals. When that war was over, the same exact branch of the government turned it loose on the farms, turned it loose on the environment that we ate from and everything else.
Yeah, I'm a chemist.
Yes, yeah.
Right? Those companies are amongst the most creative in terms of their original research.
Yes.
In order to produce materials that have this other side to them. That is the beneficial side,
yes.
Which, you know, DDT is very unambiguous, right? So the decision isn't necessarily the chemical companies themselves. It's us. It's not the chemical companies that are the sort of the hyenas of this operation. Mm-hmm. But they are producing and they understand how to do transformations.
Yep.
And they will say, oh, look, you know, this is good for this. It's society that uses these materials, not the chemical companies. I'm not absolving them of responsibility for not perhaps always being open and straightforward about what are some of the other impacts of these materials. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it's us. It's the society.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, you say it's the leaders, it's all
the society.
Of us.
Well, it's challenging. There's the society, and then there are forces like Department of Energy. So we may say society built an atomic weapon, but not really did society build an atomic weapon. Very specific people did.
Yeah, right. Well, let's take that.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, in the end, what is the conclusion of having created nuclear weapons? The conclusions are things that were not possibly understood at the beginning.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so that, in a sense, to me, absolves an awful lot of responsibility from the people who were pushing to be able to do this. And it did end the war. I mean, this is the Truman approach, right? It says, if I don't use it, you know, end 100,000 Americans. If I use it, you know, end 1,000.
That's right.
Japanese.
But that really proves my point. There's actually very few people making decisions on behalf of other interests. We may call it society's interest. When you are a chemical company who's operating on a system of economics in which you pass on the externalities to the people and you don't tell them that's what you're doing, then society isn't making an informed choice.
Neither is the chemical company. Because they don't have all that information. I mean, it takes years and years and years to know.
That's right.
But anyway, we've had to.
Well, that's a good point. So let's.
Well, hang on.
Go ahead.
Our time is also chunks.
So that's very good.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Robert Figueroa from the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion, Oregon State University. We'll be back in one moment to continue this interesting conversation. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Robert Figueroa from the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at Oregon State. And so none of us can be absolved of responsibility because we're all in an environment, a big environment here, where unintended consequences, we don't have enough information to make that very measured decision at the end. I mean, I read a book, who the devil was it? It was a Nobel laureate who was pointing out that scientists, and he was a scientist, we have this luxury of sitting back and saying, well, there's this probability, that probability, and we're never going to come up with 100% probability because that's not what science that's not the decision in science in the general. But he said, and that's why I rather admire judges and politicians. He said, because they have to make a decision, right? They just don't have the luxury that an academic that I have of whittling away and, you know, yes. But on the other hand, they've got to make a decision. And society knows that. Society makes its decisions the same way.
Yeah, I guess this the homogeneous blob of society, I want to diversify. And I want to diversify in as many dimensions as possible, racially, ethnically, ability, age, and income, and look at it from that point of view. Because there are people who think they're not really empowered in the society they're in. There are others who have power and wield power in different ways. So if we think back to the scientists for a moment, and I worked with the National Science Foundation and the American Philosophical Association to do a grant on science diversity. How is philosophy of science contributing to diversity, and how is it not? And I wrote a book with a philosopher, or edited a book with a philosopher, Sandra Harding, who's a renowned founder of feminist philosophy of science. And we put together this book called Science and Other Cultures. And one of the points is, if you don't have a diverse community, then you lose some of the opportunities of your diversity of thought, your diversity of thinking. And we might say, okay, so that's more scientific information. Not exactly. Scientists are in their own environments. They construct their own environments, and they maintain something of the status quo. They tend to be conservative, and not politically is what I'm saying, but conservative in the sense of you don't just say, okay, that's it. Everything is wrong here. You have to look at what are the greatest probabilities and what are the likelihoods. But that doesn't mean that we don't make choices of what not to look at, and it doesn't absolve science of ethics. Science is not value-free. It's not purely objective. It seeks out the virtues of objectivity, which is what reason does. It seeks out the virtues of objectivity. Scientific progress is great, but progress is already presuming that whatever science puts into the world, progress equals good. Good is a term of ethics. Progress is not a term of science. It's a term of social ethics. So we need to hold scientists ethically accountable.
Okay, let's do two things here. I mean, it's a pity we don't have another program. But, philosophy of science, and you're working with this philosopher of science.
Sandra Harding.
Sandra Harding, correct. And I'd like to read that book. Mm. Very briefly for the audience, what is your definition of philosophy of science?
Yeah, so what you're asking is what kind of knowledge is scientific knowledge? That would be a basic question. Is there a particular standard of logic or laws of logic? Now, this was the early 20th century ideas of philosophy of science, but it grew after Thomas Kuhn to recognize that science is moving with the forces of politics, of technology, of constitutional governments. It's a historical moment. And it's a social activity. So if we look at our science and we say, okay, what is it doing predominantly? Then we can say, oh, that's its social activity. If a branch of science is fed almost completely by the military-industrial complex funding, then we have to ask, what does science do?
Okay.
And what it does is in that case, many, many things. You know, it could be inventing the internet. That would be great out of a military budget or something like that. But nonetheless, it's hiding itself behind two things, the military-industrial complex and the falsehood of non-value-laden judgment. Okay. So you hide behind one, there's your power, and then on the other,
and so
you
then
do something
the people
else.
Who worry about this and try to dissect it, these are philosophers of science in
so
a sense,
that's,
right?
That's right.
And that's
yeah.
just one example
that's
of science.
Right. That's
I mean,
right.
there's
Absolutely.
Many others that don't have this dichotomy and this dilemma.
That's right. That's right. Citizen science would be a great example of where people working and tinkering without the institution can still come to those scientific discoveries, and that's a great example.
Because there are people that will tell you that universities are the sort of the resource for a society to be able to do research that can't be funded anywhere else because there's no driving force.
But who are they funded by? Most of my friends who are working in the big physics are being funded by the Navy.
No, we all are.
So they're not being funded by the university.
But what I'm trying to point out, there are people that think that we are too dependent on that source of funding for what the devil we'd like to do.
Yes.
And we can't just run off because there is no place in society that just throws out a bunch of cash and says, hey, follow your nose. And that can lead to good or bad. Well, okay. Now, the other point that you made earlier, you talked about this lovely expression, diversity of science or diversity in science. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, and I want to come back and question you about it.
Yeah, so philosophers talk in language like epistemology, which is the study of knowledge. And the idea is the more sources for your knowledge, the greater chances that you will have proper answers or the right level of conservatism or voices that you may not have heard.
Or the right level of adventure.
Or the right level of adventure. So if you have a rather homogeneous population of people taking on science, so for many years, predominantly men, predominantly white, their lives that they enjoy as men who are white, their privileges, go into the science. It's extremely subtle, but not subtle when you look at it on a big institutional level like a university. It determines who will be your graduate students, who will be the future of science. It determines what industries will be there. And if it's predominantly male and it continues its intergenerational, I want my male student, the same kind of club. But if we, so now introduce someone else to the pie and hopefully if the institution isn't too prejudiced, which they do tend to be in their own just habitual framing, but if it's not too prejudiced, then we get new knowledge. We get new practices.
Okay. That's the gospel, according to Robert Figueroa.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Now, the alternative to that, or an argument that says that's a little naive, is as follows. And I must say, I didn't come up with this sort of idea. We have a very interesting lady in a philosophy of science department here. Her name is Deepanwita Dasgupta. And she works with me on some funding that we've got for training underrepresented scientists, underrepresented minorities into science, mainly Latina and Latinos in this particular environment. But she says, Keith, okay, so you're increasing the diversity of the workforce. She said, I can see that, and we do a good job, I must say. But she said, I don't see that that's increasing any diversity in science, right? Because the training is the same, and she goes back to India, right? That fantastic science can come out of India. Mm-hmm. And she says, but the trouble is they're all emulating their mentors from Oxford or Cambridge, and so they're all really going along the same tram lines. And there's not been a lot of diversity in science itself. Just because you have a diverse workforce, but the training is all pretty much similar. And that extra feature of growing up in a larger Latino family or a small whatever, doesn't necessarily apply.
Exactly.
And I thought that was a very interesting argument for her to make.
I think it is the argument. I think it's a poor argument.
Ah, good.
So here's why. People's experiences in life give them the creativity that others may not have. And the brain science demonstrates that the more ways that you can combine differences, so you know, try something that is a particular, you know, a corkscrew here, and then use it in a completely different, you know, environment, different conformation, and then you get a scientific creativity. If I'm coming from a very different place, I may actually have different ways of asking the questions. Now, if the institution of the science does not accept those as scientific reasonings and forces me into a bottle that I can only ask my question in the language and in the style that the scientists do, then there is no diversity in science. But what the argument is saying is, as long as everybody is towing the line to the leaders of Cambridge and Oxford and whichever, that's good. So that's a way, that's called assimilation. If you assimilate anybody, then you say, we've got a really diverse workforce. We've got very diverse Republicans, very diverse Democrats. But, you know, they're all like, so.
But
so,
I guess she's saying.
Well, let me spin
could,
it. Let me spin it for you so that you actually may get something. For one, in India, that's just not the case. Scientists are far more politically active than women sciences in the United States. So women in India learn those sciences, and then they go to the community and they fight and they battle. Whereas our scientists may not have that same kind of thing. So it's a question of how society expects sciences to behave.
We've just got 2 minutes.
Yes. Okay, 2 minutes.
It's, given the breadth and depth of what we're doing here is ridiculous. But, okay, you talk about the institutions. I think what Deepinwita might say to that is she thinks that science itself is the institution, right? And that is, therefore, doesn't matter who you've got inside this institution, because of the nature of science, that it's not going to be diverse in its approaches to things because of the institution of science, not the individual university, company, government.
Sure, sure.
And I still find it a compelling argument.
But that's where I see that India does it differently.
Well, no, but she's also applying
for,
here.
For example. I guess we, out of time, would say that I disagree. The history of science just simply doesn't tell us what she's telling us.
Okay.
The history of science doesn't.
Then I've got to go away and read some articles that you direct me to to disprove this.
I'm
and
looking
show
forward
me.
To having right. this conversation.
Okay. Hey, Robert, that's the end. We don't have any more time.
I'm very honored to be here.
That's the end of the program, folks. I'd like to thank you again, Robert, for being here. Sam Cassiano for putting this thing together so it sounds so entertaining and interesting. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.